Conspiracy U by Scott Shea delivers an urgent wake-up call for everyone who cares about the future of civil society and is concerned that universities today are failing at teaching students how to strive for truth, but rather guiding students to blindly trust theories driven by ideology. The book provides a roadmap for reform based on universal moral and intellectual standards and offers a way out of the culture wars that are ripping America apart. A perfect gift for anyone who is sending their children off to college. Available now for pre-order, found wherever books are sold.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the October 13th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He was born ready. He's an author, a political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Will, I was born ready.
I think from now on, we need to have the just normal conversational exchanges that go on before Brian hits record. That needs to become a part of the show. And I do not want you to change a thing about your approach.
Actually, I had a conversation with President Trump about this once, and he said that you never have anything to worry about with hot mics. That it's all good. You can just sort of say what you want. Nothing will ever happen.
Hey, we have so much to get to. And I mean, like, loads of stories. And I want to thank all of the listeners who really do dutifully send me at least story ideas for us. It's just a cornucopia that's blowing out all kinds of fruits and other produce. Every week we get great story ideas from listeners, and we don't get to all these stories, but so many good ones. And they were coming in as we were getting ready to go here. So thank you. Keep it up, dear listeners.
We really do have the best listeners. Some of the stuff they send, it's fantastic. They're engaged. Yep. They have great comments. I spoke at a conference today in New York City. I had someone come up to me, lives in New York, says he's gotten to know my stuff, started off listening to Radio Free California, and that wow. he was engaging with some of the topics we've discussed. And it was just really impressive how sharp and astute, and I don't know, I'm encouraged by our listeners. What we lack in quantity, we make up for in quality.
That's right. Hey, we have, as I say, loads of letters, and I wonder if I can just run through them fairly quickly. These are also listeners who took my request to heart. That is concision is the mind of God or something like that. I can't remember. Anyway, I've got Stefan Buczek, who wrote, you might remember that last week I was talking about, or was it 2 weeks ago, I was talking about how Governor Gavin Newsom's office micromanages PG&E through the supposedly independent state regulators at the Public Utilities Commission. And I mentioned multiple times that the story I was referring to was from ABC 10 in the Bay Area. Stefan very generously, who works in TV, by the way, Stefan said the ABC affiliate in the Bay Area is KGO TV Channel 7. ABC 10 is in Sacramento. Grateful for that correction. Elsewhere in, let's call it not so much a correction as, well, yes, it's also a correction, but it has such great merit. This is from listener Chris Tremarco. And remember, David, last week we were talking about Gordon Klein, who's a professor in the Anderson School at UCLA, the business school there. And this is the guy who got a letter from a student saying, hey, you know, given all the terrible activities over the summer in social justice terms, you know, the George Floyd murder, the riots, the police shootings elsewhere, you should really make sure that Black students get a pass on all tests in the MBA program. And the teacher, Gordon Klein, a professor who's also a consultant, wrote back, you know, no, I'm not going to give people a pass on the basis of their gender, ethnicity, or race. I just won't do it. And that led to calls for his resignation. On the podcast, Chris writes, you paraphrased an email that started it all as authored by a Black student, I think. Well, the student who sent the email declined to start this ball rolling was not Black. As a side note, which is very interesting, that same non-Black student proceeded to enroll in a class for the next term, also being taught by Klein. You get the significance of that, I'm sure. So I'm not sending this, he continues, just to nitpick or correct. There's a further point. For decades, the paternalistic progressives who are not part of a certain group have decided when and why said group should be offended or have a grievance. The non-Black UCLA student is playing that same role. He goes on at some length, but I just thought that was a really great point to make and a really wonderful correction.
Yes, indeed.
Then we have a listener, Susan Page, who wrote about our comments that Gavin Newsom is literally trying to make abortion tourism a kind of a new state industry in California. And she writes, when I was a Foreign Service officer posted to Lithuania from 1996 to 2000, and that's a great way to open up an email. When I was a Foreign Service officer posted to Lithuania, she saw an interesting relic from the Soviet Union, which I now see in California. And that is that the most prevalent method of birth control in the USSR was abortion for a whole bunch of reasons. I see that belief now in the Democrat Party and corporate media, which have made abortion a litmus test of political fealty, as you discussed in this week's show. What I find so hard to come to grips with in 2021 America is that all these people touting abortion are apparently stuck back in the early 1960s mindset when there was no readily available birth control. That all went into history later in the decade with the pill. If abortion advocates really cared about empowering women, they would preach responsibility and maybe how to prevent pregnancy in the first place. Any thought?
There's a kind of, you know, common sense to the idea that the sexual revolution, both, I think, made more permissible this idea of greater sexual activity outside the confines of marriage and commitment and other things that I think have been, you know, largely one of the biggest disasters in human history. But then her point is also true that it did, in theory, produce the a mechanism that could allow for sexual activity without pregnancy, or at least severely limit it. Because I've spent the last couple of days being a part of a Catholic economics conference, and I know that my good brothers and sisters that have been here at this event with me have a theological opinion on contraception that I don't share, but I was just wondering if there's anybody out there that is pro-abortion but anti-contraception, because I was going to... Obviously, that wouldn't be our Catholic friends who would be vehemently opposed to both, you know, with a certain consistency to their ethic, their sexual and life and marital ethic. But I just wonder if there is any, because these days I don't take anything for granted about logical consistency. There may be someone out there that could say, oh, I had to abort the kid. Well, how come you didn't use birth control? Because I didn't believe in that.
Yeah, right. I'm waiting for that. That needs to go into a movie that you're writing. Hey, can I ask you a couple of questions about, or make some comments about your book? There's No Free Lunch. One of our listeners says, this is a listener, Chris, a different Chris. Is there a way to get David's new book outside of Amazon? I've been 5 years sober from buying on their platform. And I'm wondering, can they just buy it directly from your, like there's No Free Lunch website? Or
no, my website links to the retailers, because we don't want to be in the fulfillment business and I don't care about the margin. And so, but barnesandnoble.com has the book,
which I recommend.
It's available. It's distributed by Simon & Schuster. It's available at most brick and mortar bookstores. So to the extent that someone's trying to avoid Amazon, there are certainly other, you know, retailers, both brick and mortar and online, that would have it available. And Barnes & Noble is still about 10% of market share of books e-commerce, which is, you know, significantly lower than what their presence was, you know, many moons ago as an overall retailer of book sales. But, you know, 10% of online book sales is still a pretty big number. Mm-hmm. So unless the individual, I think you said the name was Chris, is both boycotting Amazon and Barnes & Noble, that's probably the easiest way to do it, is just go to barnesandnoble.com and do an electronic commerce transaction there. But I am still such a huge fan of bookstores. I love bookstores. Mm-hmm. I love holding a book, buying a book, looking at a book.
I love used bookstores. That's kind of my thing. Like the Bookman over in Tustin, I just like to hang out there.
But then you know what's funny is even used books, Amazon with its third party transactions. I got a Kuiper book that just came today. I've been waiting for a long time. And I spent like the same that I think I spent on my first car to get the book, but you can't get it anywhere. And Amazon's ability to match buyers and sellers of some really rare classic books, Kuiper's book on economics, which is not in print still. And it's a hardback original deal. This is like a gem. So but look, if he doesn't want to buy from Amazon, then sure, there's other ways to do it. And, you know, we still got to figure out ways, Will, that we're going to handle getting free copies of the book to our loyal listeners, given certain criteria. I haven't quite sorted out that yet. So we'll have to give that some thought offline before we launch the most generous giveaway program in history.
Well, one of the ways we discussed was it's not a free book giveaway. We talked about having people purchase it online from, say, Amazon and then send us the proof of purchase. And I said, you will send them a book plate. You said, what's a book plate? Listener Nancy and several others asked the same question, but not quite the way that listener Nancy did. She wrote, oh, my God, how old is David? Who doesn't know what a book plate is? Tell him I'm expecting my quote unquote sticker and a full plate, preferably from Mastro's. So one of the ideas I had was we get you a book plate, the Bonson Group, you sign it to that person because we already have a few people who've said like, look, I'm going to buy this online. That way the book sales go up. That's a great gift. I think I'm just recommending we just figure out a way to get you to sign a few of these to these listeners and then we'll, mail them out as long as they send you a proof of purchase.
Yeah. So let's sort through the details offline.
Okay. And then Donald Davidson asks, do you know if the new book is going to be recorded and released on Audible?
Yeah, it's already it's already recorded. Thanks to our producer, Brian Tong. He and I spent a couple of days doing all that, as we also did for my prior releases of the Crisis of Responsibility book and the Elizabeth Warren book. This book is fully recorded and done and edited and mastered. And we are going to release it on Audible and Amazon's, audio chapter, which is Audible, a few days early. So it will be available for purchase and live download near the end of October. I don't know the exact date right now, but it will be before the street date of the book.
Here's the rest of Donald's email. I like to listen to good books during long car rides and while doing penance on my bicycle. I listen to Crisis of Responsibility that way. And then he concludes sort of with a P.S. Sorry for making you, Will, the intermediary on this, but I know David doesn't like to receive emails from the hoi polloi. Okay, so David, lots to talk about here. I just want to do a couple of updates. We talked last week about Merrick Garland and his memo that went out. Just to recap the story, the National School Board Association writes a letter to Merrick Garland, the attorney general, and says, oh my gosh, there's a clear and present danger, an immediate threat from a rising kind of revolutionary populist tide of parents who present a kind of terror threat to school board members and school teachers. And they proceeded to list 24 incidents that they described as their evidence for needing the federal government to step in. And Garland, within hours of receiving this email, apparently, somehow just miraculously pulls together a memo for the FBI and says, we got to get on top of this. We got to stop this tide of people, parents who are showing up at school board meetings or homes of school board members, threatening education, public servants, as he called them. And so our friends over at National Review, Caroline Downey in particular, the reporter, wrote a wonderful story that came out just as we had already wrapped up our show. And her headline kind of tells you everything. Vast majority of incidents cited by school board group to justify federal intervention didn't involve threats. She goes through kind of almost point by point and just lists the examples that these guys cite. And her conclusion is, that most of these things consisted, she says, 16 of the 24 consisted of tense verbal exchanges between parents and school board members that did not escalate to threats of physical violence. And in many of these cases, the aggravated parents disrupted school board meetings by angrily objecting to their district's mandatory masking policies and or embrace of critical race theory curricula. And she says, there were a few claims none of them proved yet, of, you know, kind of criminal doing, a threatening letter to one school board member, another school board member who says that people in cars stopped at his house to photograph his address. You know, maybe somebody else reports receiving a death threat in Loudoun County, Birmingham Public Schools. This is one where I disagree with her. She says, under the heading of, you know, legitimate threats, at a Birmingham Public School Board meeting, an audience member gave a Nazi salute. Even if the person meant it with sort of like vile intention, that's not criminal. That is speech. As repellent as I find it, that is speech, and it is protected. And it's more likely, I would argue, that the person giving the Nazi salute was doing it to mock the school board. Like, you're acting like fascists. Not saying I'm a Nazi, but that's, you know, the school board association presents this as a clear threat. So anyway, I'll pop that story in the show notes, but I just wanted to update it, that thing is still ongoing, and its intention quite clearly, the intention of the teachers unions, the school board associations, which are all irretrievably left wing. Their intention is clearly to chill speech, to be able to wave this threatening document from Garland in the face of parents who are dissenting from school board policy and say, you know, basically, we could make this very bad for you. You know, we could call in the FBI if you don't. And this is what the left would decry as, you know, the classic Karen move. I'm going to call the cops and tell them what's going on here. Clearly intended by the Biden administration on behalf of their allies and the teachers union to really chill any dissent and to limit the parental role in teaching.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. Michael O'Brien Doherty, who is one of the co-hosts of the Editor's Podcast on National Review and has become a friend of mine over the last several years, is a very thoughtful political commentator. And he pointed out this is actually becoming perhaps the most predictable thing in politics. You could also argue it's predictable because it might be effective. It might have worked for them. But if you go back to the pro-life efforts in the early 1990s, there was a desire to radicalize them as domestic terrorists. Then President Clinton and Janet Reno went to great effort to kind of lump all small government advocates, a particularly broad array of people, as if they were one and the same with an unbelievably tiny array of people. That was the Ruby Ridge, Waco, Oklahoma City, the kind of fanaticism that was going on with some of these militia groups. What were they called that Trump talked about in the debate? The Proud Boys.
Proud Boys, yeah.
Yeah. So there's this thing right now where you and I call it nut picking, but usually we're calling it that on when we're talking about guys on our side. And I think they're taking an example from the left that isn't really necessarily a fair representation and trying to paint a broad brush. I do think that what you're seeing here with this Garland move is not only dishonest, just because it, from all looks of things, it just plain didn't happen. But like, if someone wanted to come back and go, look, here's the case. There's a documented case. There was this one parent who got out of control and did this. I wouldn't be like, oh, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't know that. I'll take at face value that there's one or two cases. We don't call in the federal government. First of all, it isn't their jurisdiction.
Right.
It isn't even a little bit their jurisdiction. No one in their right mind thinks there's a federal safety threat, whether it's one parent, two parents, or 10 parents. I happen to think it's one or two, but the idea that there's a systemic threat against school boards that requires federal intervention, this is Orwellian.
Yeah.
And it's rooted though in a lie. That is also MBD's point, a consistently used lie, constantly claiming that the right is guilty by simple disagreement on COVID policy, on CRT, on abortion, on the Tea Party, right? They said this was this kind of domestic. Mm-hmm. This has got to stop, and we shouldn't do it, but we really don't. But where we do, I'll call it out. You'll call it out. We're always good on consistency. But I got to say, this is totally, completely unacceptable. And Merrick Garland is to be clowning himself. I thought he was a left-wing, center-left, but respectable jurist. This is a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, that's been one of the most amazing revelations. It was like I got shot in the face with cold water when I saw Garland put this out, because I was thinking, my gosh, if not for Mitch McConnell saying he wouldn't hear, you know, wouldn't usher through his candidacy for the Supreme Court, that guy who does not understand the First Amendment or the limits of federal power, as outlined in something called the U.S. Constitution, would now be sitting on the Supreme Court and delivering this kind of stuff as the law of the land. It is a real terrifying insight into his character and his qualification for the office he's in now, never mind the Supreme Court. There's a little bit of math here, and I just want to point out, there's an ally of ours, California Policy Center, as some of our listeners know, also runs a project called the Parent Union, where we bring in parents, and they had always been in the past just parents of students in low-income communities with lousy public schools, and we help them to amplify their voice and get the best education for their kids. But increasingly, our membership now comprises people who are highly educated, somewhat well-off, and just outraged by what they're saying, and frequently even liberal. So one of those people talks to Caroline Downey in the article that I mentioned in National Review. Her name is Wenyin Wu. She's Asian American. She runs Californians for Equal Rights Foundation. And she points out, she works primarily in the San Diego County. And she points out that this is a handful of confrontations between parents and public school officials. It's a handful, especially if you do the math. She points out for Caroline, there are 1,000 school districts in California alone, each with an elected board. Those boards meet regularly, at least once a month. So that's about 9,000 regular meetings in the past 9 months of this year. If you multiply that number by the total number of school boards nationwide, 24 incidents is a drop in the bucket. She says, it's like calling 911 for a paper cut. Maybe there were a few isolated incidents of disruption or dissent, but that's not even 1% of all concerned parents. They are cherry picking the evidence. So anyway, that's the update there. I wanted to talk about the oil spill because we talked about that last week.
When you're done with the oil spill, I have some breaking news for you.
Oh, go for it, brother. I want to hear.
Donald J. Trump, the former president of the United States, has just issued a fatwa, a dictum, a memo. He can't tweet it. So it goes, it's on his website. It just went 1 minute ago. If we don't solve the presidential election fraud of 2020, which we have thoroughly and conclusively documented, Republicans will not be voting at all in 22 or 24. It's the single most important thing for Republicans to do. Okay. Go ahead. Back to the oil spill.
Hard to follow up with on that.
Remember, though, the reason you got to vote for Trump is because we must stop the radical left. We must stop cancel culture. We must stop wokeism. We have to do whatever we can to stop the crazy progressive socialist left.
Including not vote.
These people better be apologizing to you and me. I'll tell you that right now. Go ahead. Move on.
All right. So last week we talked about the oil spill off the Orange County coast. You and I discussed it, I think, pretty thoroughly, pointing out that some of the reaction immediately was speculative and overreaction. We had a group of Laguna Beach residents immediately sue the oil company. We had an Orange County congressman rush back to Congress after a helicopter flight over the oil patch. Off Huntington Beach, he immediately pointed out that he was moving legislation through the U.S. Congress to ban all offshore oil drilling. You came up with what I think was the line of the episode, and that was basically, okay, I'll cut you a deal. No more offshore oil drilling in exchange for unlimited oil drilling on land. And of course, these knuckleheads will never go for that. A foolish consistency, they would say. So what we now know is that the oil spill was far smaller than first announced, likely maybe like a tenth the size or less, but maybe a tenth of the size of what they originally estimated. I'm not a tenth, maybe. Let's see. They originally estimated like 150,000 gallons were spilled and have now concluded that number might be as low as, say, 23,000 gallons, most of which they've already collected, by the way, through oil skimming and collection of tarballs, et cetera. And Huntington Beach has reopened its shoreline. This is a story that came out Monday. We're recording on Wednesday. So Huntington Beach has already reopened. They came back with non-detectable amounts of oil-associated toxins in the water. Then I just wanted to point this out, that The Oiled Wildlife Network reports that 65 birds recovered in total, 38 of which were found dead from the oil spill. So 38 bird fatalities. And I want to point out that the governor of California is trying to shut down fossil fuels. The Dems are trying to shut down offshore oil drilling because it kills wildlife. And you'll see these stories about, oh my gosh, the wildlife, the devastation, repeated without a reference to a number. This is the first number I've been able to check out, 38 bird deaths. And I want to point out that the solar plant that operates in San Bernardino County, if you've ever driven east out of Southern California, I think it's on the 10 or the 15. I think it's a 15. You go to Vegas. I think that's a 15. There's this plant called the Ivanpah Solar Plant. It is this monolithic sci-fi looking structure of concentric circles of mirrors, all collecting sun rays and reflecting them back at a tower that is filled with a salt fuel kind of thing that heats up and generates electricity. That system, the Ivanpah Solar Plant in San Bernardino County, kills approximately 1,000 times that number of bird deaths every single year. About 6,000 birds are just like vaporized when they fly through this reflected sunlight to collect solar, because of course solar is clean and there's nothing wrong with it, and it's going to power the new California economy. So the value of being a conservative is remembering that there is no utopia, that almost everything is tragic. I think about our Native American forebears and how when they killed a buffalo, you know, they would pray over its spirit, supposedly. I only know this from reading about it. I wasn't there, even though I'm that old, David. But that what they were doing was they were praying and saying, like, look, man, I'm really sorry that I had to kill you in order to eat and sustain my life. As human beings, we live in a tragic and fallen world. We must, to some extent, sacrifice some things. And so the question is, what are the trade-offs? And there's like no thought here about the trade-off from fossil fuels to solar. One is understood as filthy, the other is understood as clean. And we've got our governor telling us, you know, all the time that we're going to move to a completely fossil-free system, and that solar is going to be great and we're all going to be happy and there's not going to be any pollution. So I just wanted to make that point, David.
Yeah, I mean, the economic, the point of there's no free lunch, the book coming out, is the reality of trade-offs in economics. But this is exactly applicable in the energy conversation. And it's really fascinating when you get to talk to really anti-fossil, anti-carbon leftists that are really honest and intellectually forthright, they all admit that they're trade-offs. They may have different opinions than I do about how we get there and what decarbonization needs to look like. But there is an honesty from a small, and it's a really small number of these folks, about the limits of solar and wind and renewables. It's fascinating, though, how undermining of their own position, they're willing to be the extremist by claiming that things that can't do something can, as if we're not going to find out.
Right.
And then what do they think is going to happen to that pendulum? That it's not going to swing back radically in favor of fossil fuel? I think they're, if I were on their side of all the issues, and I'm not, although I am super in favor of the idea of cleaner carbon emissions, reducing carbon and utilizing a more natural way of generating energy, improving the technology. There's a lot of things that could be said about this. And I think I've talked on the podcast plenty about my fondness of use of natural gas to power mm-hmm. electricity production versus coal. But the reality is that if I felt the way all of them did, I think it's very important for them to temper what they're saying, because people are not going to be willing to go without power. And wind and solar are going to be having these other side effects for a long time and be totally limited in their capacity. Therefore, setting a realistic expectation behooves their self-interest, their argumentative interest.
The same public officials who decry PG&E for its alleged role in burning down huge swaths of California, especially in Northern California, are seemingly unable to make the connection between PG&E, a utility that transmits electricity across vast distances in the West, and the utility they say is going to save us from climate change. I predict, not alone in this, of course, that nuclear is going to make a gigantic comeback over the next few years. I want to point out that in other news of California, this great story from Sacramento Bee, the headline says almost all of it: Texas, Florida, Ohio, and more. California's state travel ban now covers one third of America. Here's the lead from the story by Andrew Sheeler and Philip Reese. California Democrats wanted to send a message when they passed a law 5 years ago banning taxpayer-funded travel to states that allow businesses to deny services to gay and transgender people. They took a stand, but that didn't discourage Republican states from adopting those laws anyway. Since then, California has banned state-funded travel to 18 states with a total population of 117 million people. That's a little more than a third of the nation's overall population. So I could go on. It's a great story. I'll pop it into the show notes. And it's really worth talking about California's deep desire always to virtue signal. And among the virtue signaling, you know, part of it is that we won't allow publicly funded travel by government officials to a third of America. And particularly,
didn't we find out, though, that there was an exception for student athletes and college football teams? So that's good.
Well, it appears
like, in other words, guys actually going to states and doing real commerce in that state.
That's right.
They can generate tons of revenue in those states.
Yes. But I will say there appears to be some disagreement on this. You and I checked it out, and it looks like, I think Tony Lima was the guy who told me about it, that there's the exemption includes people who had contracts before the state was banned from travel. And then I went online and looked around at some of the football schedules for schools, California public schools that are involved in Pac-12 football alone. And their contracts to show up and play in some of these states go out to 2026, 2027. So those are pre-existing contracts. And also, this can't stop them from raising money privately in order to pay for their trips. I think Cal Berkeley did that for its baseball team at one point. There's a guy named Michael Schellenberger, David, and I don't know if you've been following.
By the way, I don't accept that at all.
Well, please go ahead.
If I felt so strongly like this is blood money,
you can't do it.
And these states are literally just like Nazis in what they're doing with their LGBT policies, I would say, I know we signed a contract, but we're not going.
There you go.
Like, this is, it's just the moral foundation here. The moral argument is too strong. We're not going.
For no reason.
What if it was like, you know, literally a Hitlerian thing, and you're like, well, we signed a contract, so we got to go.
Got to build the trains and the death camps. Yeah, sorry.
These people are so full of it. I'm just sick of it. Just put up or shut up.
Hey, have you been following this guy, Michael Schellenberger, David? His kind of claim to fame. Well, like me, he is I think, former lefty. He may still be a Democrat or a liberal, but he is really starting to light up progressives in a very big way. You can find his stuff on Substack, and I'll put his latest article, which I just find absolutely amazing, on the show notes. The headline is "More Black Americans Died from San Francisco's Drug Experiment in 1 Year Than Died from the Tuskegee Experiment in 40 years." It's a great article in which he talks about the fact. Let me just cut right to the money graph here. He says progressives have, what we're talking about here, Schellenberger says, is, and you and I have discussed myriad examples of this from across the state, but primarily in San Francisco, where the city has decided that it is going to hand out drugs, house people who actively are using drugs, help people get needles and other equipment they might need to smoke crack, for instance. And Schellenberger says, quote, progressives justify withholding the best available medical treatment in drug addiction. That is helping people abstain from using drugs. Progressives justify withholding that in the name of reducing racial disparities in jails and prisons. But the result of the city's hands-off policy is far worse. It produces racial disparities in drug deaths. African-American men in San Francisco were almost six times more likely to die from illicit drugs than the average San Francisco resident. Indeed, San Francisco is engaged in an unethical refusal to mandate proven medical treatment to drug addicts that is no different from the denial of medical treatment to syphilis sufferers by U.S. government researchers in Tuskegee, Alabama, between 1932 and 1972. In those infamous racist experiments, U.S. health and medical professionals denied penicillin to African-American men long after it became clear in 1947 that the antibiotic saved lives. So willfully withholding known treatments that actually work to help people get off drugs, San Francisco will not employ, because that would be racist.
Well, because of jail inequity, like disproportionate jail.
Yes.
Well, that's a fascinating moral argument. We must kill more Black people because we don't want more Black people going to jail.
There you go.
That's, first of all, I'm now going to read the article myself. That's a brilliant point of view and claim, and you know how strongly I feel on this issue. I would love for this to become something that people understand more intuitively about the folly of this leftist instinct. This is so dehumanizing. And to try to flower it up and sprinkle some lovey-dovey, like, look, we don't want more people in jail, so therefore we're going to go create a disproportionately high amount of drug addiction and drug death and malady is surreal. It's unfathomable that we're having this conversation. It really is.
And Schellenberger's point is that San Francisco has kind of become the model. As I said, Newsom loves to virtue signal. We'll get to more of that in just a moment. But this is a California pathology, this deep desire to signal how we're the leaders, we're the best. And in San Francisco's case, this model of helping addicts and, you know, scratch the itch has been adopted, as Schellenberger points out here and elsewhere, has been adopted by cities across the country, but only in progressive cities. If you're a Black person or a white person and you want to use drugs, you go to San Francisco. You don't go necessarily to Orange County because they're not going to hand out drugs here, or, you know, Alpine or Placer County or Inyo or Kern. They're not going to hand you drugs over there, but that may not be too far off too. In another article that we didn't get to right when it came out, just at the end of September, an article by a bunch of National Public Radio affiliates who combined in California to write a story about the impact of smoke from wildfires on both the environment and on people. Huge surprise. We've talked about this a little bit. California keeps talking about how climate change is really critical, and then we do nothing to manage our forests, with the result that those forests burn with such regularity. There's one burning right now up in Santa Barbara County. I don't know, David, if you've been watching this one, the Alisal fire, it's called. It's already burned 15,000 acres. Remember when Gavin...
How contained is it now?
It was, when I looked at it this morning, it was 5%, and there was a wind advisory for this afternoon. So you got a problem. They've already shut down north and southbound traffic on the 101 through Santa Barbara. This is just below Solvang's and Goleta, along very close to the coast on the 101. But, you know, this is another devastating fire that's threatening to get way out of hand. And meanwhile, people are, you know, the governor is doing very little, in fact, lying about it. As we pointed out, it was one of these NPR, National Public Radio reporters, Scott Rodd, up at Cap Radio in Sacramento, who was the guy who really went back and looked at Newsom's claim that he had helped mitigate, I want to say it was 100,000 acres or something like that, or 500,000 acres. He'd helped mitigate, you know, future wildfires by cleaning up some of the state forests and wildlands. And it was Scott Rodd, who found out that, in fact, Newsom had done like a tenth or a sixth of what he had claimed to have cleaned up. Newsom lied and people died. I remember when that was a famous line about George W. Bush and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But here he is. Newsom lied about this, didn't do what he said he would do. People are dying now. Their homes are being incinerated. And Newsom's response is, well, it's either PG&E's fault or capitalists who will not allow us to rein in climate change. And the result is still the same. These places burn down with real regularity. The smoke pours across California with terrible health impacts, especially on poor people, but not only. Apparently also has a tremendous adverse effect on livestock. Go figure. They don't like to breathe smoke either. But it spreads across the nation. And the story does a wonderful job of documenting how much wildfire smoke harms the health of Americans outside of California. And I, you know, along with our regular feature of, you know, California being a menace to society, to American society, is this new example of how we are literally, by our smoking, we're killing the rest of the country because our government's out of control. Like any reasonable president would actually start to come after California and sue it magnificently for its failure to manage this public safety threat to all of America. I do understand. Donald Trump used to troll Newsom and Dems out here regularly on this kind of stuff and was ridiculed for it. When he talked about cleaning up the forest, people made fun of him for thinking you can clean up a forest. And all he was saying was what's true. We really do need to better manage our forests. Private forests, by the way, are not burning down. Why is that? Because privately owned forests, actual foresters actually know how to manage their land. What's that old saying, David? And I think it's theological circles. I can't remember who said it first, but that which is owned by all is cared for by no one. I'll pop that one into the show notes too. It's worth reading. It's somewhat long.
Well, it should be a theological statement. It's certainly an economic one, and it's rooted in, I think, anthropological truth. But that data on the private forest not burning relative to public forest land, is that stuff you can put in the show notes?
Yeah, let me see if I can look it up again. I put it in one of our previous shows. It showed that
I guess, like, someone could maybe argue that maybe the environment, the climate change is not affecting private forests. That'd be a fun argument.
Well, it's,
you know how COVID didn't go into restaurants before like 10 o'clock.
Yes.
And it didn't spread whenever you pulled your mask down to take a bite of food, but right. It did spread in between bites of food.
Yes.
I wonder if that's how climate change works, like COVID.
I think you're coming.
It's a sneaky little devil, and it finds and it finds like certain forests to go after.
This one's public; I'll burn it down. That one's it's a kind of a capitalist oriented. Yes, I see where you're going. So let's get to we're in that part of the legislative season when the governor has piles and piles of new bills that have passed through both houses in Sacramento, the Assembly and the Senate, and they move to his desk and he's got a few weeks to read all these and sign them or just pocket veto them or actually outright veto them. In a couple of days, just a matter of days over this past weekend, Newsom signed bills to, making sure the California public schools and colleges stock their restrooms with free menstrual products. I actually think that's not such a horrible thing. In another one, you and I've talked about this one a lot. Large department stores must now display their products, including toys and toothbrushes, in gender neutral ways. There's also the retail sections. You have to have a gender neutral section for toys for boys and girls and their clothes. A new law.
And this is state law?
These are state laws, yes, that Governor Newsom signed over the weekend.
Finally. Finally, yeah. Someone taking the stuff seriously
that's
that
right.
People care about.
While the state's burning down.
What's gender neutral teeth brushing? I would have thought teeth brushing was inherently gender neutral.
You would think so, but apparently the ways you'll remember this from our discussion of a bill that was moving through that would outlaw what these activists were calling the pink tax. And that is that women pay more for products than similar products designed for men.
Right.
And you and I came up with a new business model that I wanted to roll out. And that is we're going to take all these we're going to get a hold of one of these companies that makes razors and underarm deodorants, et cetera. And we're just going to relabel everything and charge less. You got it. So,
we're big shareholders of Procter Gamble at my company, and they have a feminine product division. And one thing I'll tell you, I study their numbers. They almost all their sales are to women.
That's weird. And I think sexist.
Well, but it's like, are they targeting? Is it a certain marketing? Like,
yeah, there's something there. You're on to something. I think we got to end that. Fundamentally, in which case menstrual products no longer necessary. Another bill that he signed into law, no more gas powered equipment that includes generators.
I want the top tier, like Madison Avenue marketing agencies to come do a pitch for marketing menstrual products to men.
I love it. Yes.
And I don't mean men buying it for their wives. That doesn't do us any good.
No.
I want men buying it for men, and I want Mad Avenue to run a marketing campaign of how they're going to do it. Okay.
OB for men. New law, gas-powered equipment, including generators, lawn equipment, pressure washers, chainsaws, weed trimmers, even golf carts, now banned. under a new law. My favorite tweet on this, by the way, came from Larry Elder, who said, there's good news in California, because if you go out now to buy a generator and you find that it costs less than $950, you can steal it. And under California law, you're no longer committing a crime. So your new machinery will have to be battery powered or plug in, and there can't be anything wrong with electricity, which we already discussed. We have now a new law, America's First Ethnic Studies requirement for high school students. That'll be phased in.
Okay. That's another one. I read that when you sent that. Will, just like this thing with the college athletes going to racist, sexist, homophobic states when the contracts run out, why are we phasing in the gender studies?
This needs to happen
immediately. Yeah,
this is ethnic studies.
As a matter of fact, I want to pull people back from past years.
And make us all go back to school.
Well, why not say, okay, we can't help the fact that we accidentally gave you a diploma when you were still a racist.
That's right.
But what we will do is you're no longer allowed to have a job.
There you go. Unless you
until
take
you
this,
do like a summer credit.
Right, which we'll call
with a mask. You got to wear a mask. That's one thing.
And we'll take a page from Mao Zedong and call it re-education. I love this idea. Okay, so the biggest bill that the governor has signed, though, I would argue the one that's kind of lighting up conservatives is, and I think there's good reason here for us to be skeptical. Here's the headline from the Sacramento Bee of a couple of weeks ago, actually, now, but we're just getting around to it here. We've been holding it. California is now permanently a vote-by-mail state as Gavin Newsom signs bill. You'll remember, David, that in the run-up to the 2020 election and his recall more recently, Newsom made sure that ballots were mailed to every registered voter, regardless of their voting history. Just send it out to them immediately, because COVID is so powerful that if people actually show up to vote somewhere, they're going to get sick and then they're going to die. So Newsom expands his vote-by-mail project as just an emergency kind of an emergency response mechanism, a tool, and now has signed into law the permanentization. It's now going to be a regular feature of every election going forward that you're going that registered voters, quote unquote, will receive a ballot whether they asked for one or not. Can't see anything going wrong with that. And further, that the governor moved from 3 days to 7 days after the election, the period during which time those ballots will be allowed to arrive and still be counted. So now we no longer have election day. You will get your ballot mailed to you. You can send that in anytime you want. Those ballots are supposed to be counted, of course, expeditiously, but only on election day. And then you have 7 days if you screw up and don't send it in on time, or if somehow the mail is held up. I mean, mail being held up, you know, for a few days, I got it, but now it's 7 days. There's a lot of concern out there, I think, that this could go the wrong direction.
It's going the wrong direction.
Yeah,
It's going the wrong direction because so many people have bought into a premise that is false. The conclusion may be approved tactically by some, and it may be disapproved tactically by others. But it all comes from a premise that we need to make it as easy as possible for people to vote. And I fundamentally disagree with the premise. Once you say the goal of voting is ease, convenience, and broad participation. And then you can talk about immigrants, you can talk about felons, like there's all kinds of controversy. But just the premise, apart from getting in the hair of some of these other things, I disagree with. I don't agree for non-felon, non-immigrants, just regular old people, that the goal of voting should be to make it as easy and convenient as possible. And so, yeah, to the extent, take COVID away, if they just want, I mean, obviously the trade-off is, okay, well, we're going to put a ballot in more people's hand and they're going to have less need to go vote in a dangerous COVID-infested voting booth. So that was silly to begin with, but I don't doubt that a lot of people, I doubt Newsom cared from French Laundry, but I think a lot of people probably did believe that there was a greater risk of having, there'd be people who wouldn't go vote. Mm-hmm. And so we need to make it easier for this election cycle. Okay. Here's the thing. There are people that just have perennially believed that we want to make it as easy as possible. And that in and of itself, it's a virtue. What was it? Rock the vote. Mm-hmm. You know, every vote counting. I've always said, and I learned a lot about this from Thomas Sowell, who we could all learn a lot from in almost every subject. the goal of every election should be a quantity agnostic and quality focused. That does not mean agreement. It does not mean consensus. You want dissent in democracy. You want conflicting viewpoints. You want pluralism. However, I want people who at least have done some homework, that care, that are civically engaged. The notion that like we can just get everyone to be able to check a box, have their vote counted, there is nothing inherently good or noble about that. And in fact, it is totally contrary to de Tocqueville's America.
How so? I'm thinking of Tocqueville, especially.
Because I think Tocqueville's point about the civic pride was that it was rooted in an informed participation in democracy. That there was, now look, we've also had other past sins as a country in not allowing minority vote, not allowing women vote, you know. So I'm referring to, at whatever point we got it right, that we were letting adult people who were citizens of the country, who possess dignity and are and entitled to constitutional protection and freedom and participation, at that point forward, we allow everyone to vote as we should. But that does not mean that we are desirous of people who have no skin in the game, no understanding. I'm not saying banning them from voting. I'm not saying take a test before they vote. I'm referring to the marketing focus, that we want to market people voting as if the quantity is the sole objective. I vehemently disagree.
Hey, I want your response to this. Here's Governor Newsom as he's signing the bill. He says, as states across our country continue to enact undemocratic voter suppression laws, California is increasing voter access, expanding voter options, and bolstering elections integrity and transparency. Thoughts about that?
Well, it's all BS. I mean, It's their talking points, but there's nothing true about it, starting with the fact that other states are out trying to limit voting access. It's totally untrue. Nobody who actually gets past the talking points and the headline and the CNN clickbait and the Gavin Newsom staffer written press release, no one who gets past that stuff and looks at the meat on the bone of what Arizona and Georgia and Texas have done would even know what is supposed to be controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Having the various checks and balances and processes in place that they do, there's not the ID issue is absurd that it's even debatable. You know, in my view on the whole mail-in ballot thing is whatever resources you put into increasing mail-in ballot participation, put double those resources into verifying the validity of the votes. And I say that as someone who believes that with like 100% confidence that Donald Trump lost those votes. If we had all been able to see it, access it, and know, and there was like sort of like all the hair on this stuff was gone, I think that he got less votes in Arizona than Biden did. And I think he got less votes in Wisconsin than Biden did, and less votes in Georgia than Biden did. My point is that there's no reason to grow societal distrust and grow the opportunity for shenanigans. In the 2020 thing, my concern about this has never had anything to do with 2020's presidential election. It has to do with the fact that I want buy-in in society. I want people to have to participate in the process and the civic duty of voting. And sometimes they got to wait in line. Now, I don't want people to wait in 4-hour lines. I don't want people to not be able to get water if they're waiting outside in 100 degrees. You know, because on November 4th, it's usually about 120 degrees in most cities. I love that one. Like they want people just, you know, dying of exhaustion, heat exhaustion on November 6th or something. Right. Okay, whatever. But the identification thing is completely racist. It's completely racist to say that minorities are incapable of showing identification to vote. We do not. I'm just rehashing the same lines everyone else uses, but it's because they're right. It's not racist that they have to show ID to get in an airport.
Well,
it's not racist.
Here's
and I believe voting is a more solemn duty than getting your boarding pass.
There are two things in this. You've already hit the fact that, you know, he immediately leaps, Newsom does, to, you know, other states are doing these terrible things. Look at me. I'm doing great things. And then he moves on to say that he is bolstering elections integrity and transparency. So he's stealing a phrase from conservatives who are looking for election integrity. And in the midst of creating a system, which, as you say, is vulnerable to innumerable hacks, that is just handing out without a request, just sending ballots to everybody who has ever registered. He's undermining elections integrity, of course. And in combination with the legalization of ballot harvesting in California, there's all kinds of questions about whether the ballots are actually effectively filled out by the person to whom they were sent, if in fact they're being picked up and returned to the registrar by somebody who isn't even related to that person. But that's California law now. And when he talks about integrity and transparency, he means specifically one of the other bills he signed here, David, and that is Senate Bill 686 by Contra Costa's Steve Glazer, which, here's the Sacramento Bee's summary, would require a limited liability company that is engaged in campaign activity to provide additional information regarding its members and capital contributors to that LLC. So transparency that Newsom likes is transparency that would require a private company to begin to disclose financial information, personal information about anybody who is a member of the LLC or a capital contributor to it. So imagine this invasive now government reach into publicly disclosable info about people who are involved in a private enterprise merely because people in that private entity decided to get involved in political campaigns, you know, as supporters or whatever. This is, it was barely reported on, but it is a terrible precedent, I think. And we know that the Supreme Court just absolutely struck down California's requirement that nonprofits like mine, the California Policy Center, were required, until the Supreme Court said no a couple of months ago, that we were required to list our donors so that the state of California could determine who those people were and whether they were, you know, giving to. And sometimes this information just happened accidentally, not from us, thank God. But sometimes this information just accidentally fell into the hands of reporters and other activists who would then show up at the doorstep of people who had given money to nonprofits. But here it is again. This is the kind of transparency the government wants, which is, in your private organization, you no longer have privacy. We have the right, as soon as you enter the public sphere, we have the right to know everything about you. This can only be, like the Merrick Garland memo, this can only be an attempt to chill participation in politics by private corporations. I wanted to talk about another bill that the governor signed. This one returned a beachfront property that's now called Bruce's Beach. And David, I sent that to you at kind of the last minute as an addendum. But it did occur to me, this is a really important story. And again, it happened, the actual signing took place on, like, I don't know, September 29th or 30th, but just getting to it now. And part of the reason I've delayed in talking about this one is I'm just not sure how I feel. My response to this is very nuanced. Here's the, if you just read the mainstream media, here's the story. The city of Manhattan Beach, operating only on racist impulse, took some property from a Black family in 1924. Where this Black family had set up a kind of a beach resort, basically, for African Americans at a time when California's beaches were racially segregated, you know, that Blacks were not allowed to venture into white beaches. White people were supposed to keep away from the, you know, this is the designated Black beach. It was really like the racist apartheid South on some California stretches of California beaches. So this family buys this property for, I think it was $1,200 in like 1910 or 12. I think it was 1912. And the government of Manhattan Beach, city government, steps in and says, we're going to take that from you for eminent domain. We want to use it for other purposes. Here's $12,500, you know, roughly a tenfold return on your investment. Go away. The family went away and bought other land elsewhere. It sure does sound, as I read it at that kind of top line, I went to Wikipedia, I dug around a little bit. It does sound like this was a confiscation that was motivated by some racist intent. But then I started talking to a couple of our podcast listeners who live in that area and who said, you know, this was not driven by racism. This was a thing that actually, this move of eminent domain along the beach happened even to white property owners down in Manhattan Beach. Now, I have not been able to verify that, which is, again, a reason I'm hesitant to even bring it up. I can't check that out. In principle, the government's taking of land should be for very limited purposes. Like, we've always accepted that, you know, for a railroad line, those long ribbony stretches of highway, that the government has to. It's unpleasant. Again, it's a tragedy of modern life, but we want freeways, we want railroads, we need certain kinds of public benefit programs. Sometimes eminent domain is absolutely critical, but the government is supposed to remunerate the person from whom it takes a property. Otherwise, it violates the takings clause. But in this case, it appears that the land was left vacant for a number of years, and the city was so worked up and the county was so worked up about the possibility that the families of the property that was condemned would come back and say, like, look, man, you took the property under false pretenses, said you needed it for some sort of beachfront accommodation that would have served the public. You didn't do it. It's now just sitting there vacant. So Newsom signs a law that gives back the descendants of the Bruce family, gives them back ownership of this land. And there's a kind of repatriation there that I appreciate. The government, if you just take the mainstream media reports at face value, the government of Manhattan Beach, backed by LA County, took land from a Black family, and there were racist threats in the background. The family reported that the Klan was showing up and making noises about driving them out, and that there were all kinds of efforts to keep Black people from being able to get to Bruce's Beach. So at least at one level, I think your classical liberalism and mine inclines us to believe that a government taking property from people ought to be like the bluntest form of government violence, almost the bluntest form, but a very blunt form of government violence against an individual citizen taking the. We have this at Dodger Stadium, right? Chavez Ravine, where Dodger Stadium was built only after removing people who lived there, but they were, I think, in some cases, squatters, not necessarily owners of the land. I'm not going to back that up right now with any historical citation either. That's my memory. So please write me if you know something different. But there have been these cases where the government of California and governments across the country have stepped in and taken people's property for really dubious purposes. This may be one, and it's possible that Newsom got it right, even if he got it right for the wrong reason, which is to just declare that, you know, Democrats hate racism. And this is, Newsom's already declaring this, the model for reparations. Well, if it's a model for reparations, it will require always for the government to be the perpetrator and for the government now to be able to identify a specific victim, in this case, the descendants, the direct descendants of the Bruce family.
You know, it sounds like you had the same hesitation. I am a little hesitant to comment without knowing more of the facts themselves. But I mean, the way you've laid out the principles and the various potential situations and whatnot is exactly how I feel. I think that if land is confiscated, there needs to be remuneration. I think we have a constitution that lays out the principles around eminent domain. I barely ever believe it should be used, but where it should be, I think there's, you know, it sounds to me like there's more of a reparation theme here, that they're more saying, I mean, again, I don't know what the title was. I don't, you know, there's just a lot of details you have to see. And then you bring up that maybe it happened to a whole bunch of other families. And if that's the case, and they're only doing this remuneration three generations later for one particular African-American family and not for others of a different race, then obviously that's problematic, but we don't know if that's true. So the whole thing's just kind of messy. The reason why there's a little doubt and distrust from guys like us, who in theory are not necessarily principally opposed to what may have happened, but the reason why it's a little messy is because of the ideology of reparations that is being used to connect to this, that I think is problematic on a legal and moral basis. Paying restitution to someone not connected to something that happened, and having others who didn't do it pay it. This is actually a little different on the slavery side than the slavery side, because apparently the city of Los Angeles took the land, and the city of Los Angeles county, is giving the county is giving it back, whereas the whole point of reparations is it's sort of like the white race has to pay to the, yes. You know, there's a lot less specificity. So, yeah, I mean, if it's proven that there was some racial land grab stuff going on, I would suggest they not only get the land back, there should be a significant amount of punitive restitution as well from the racist county lords of Los Angeles, who, by the way, are keeping that persecution done now in the way that they've implemented COVID policy.
There you go. We have so many more stories to get to, but I want to just cut directly to a couple because you and I have talked about both these, and this one could be just dispatched with a simple kind of exclamation of disgust. California is the first state to ban stealthing. That is the non-consensual condom removal that we have discussed on the show and about which I can only barely speak. How you monitor, this is the practice, apparently, you know, if you believe the activists who supported this bill, this is a practice that is really widespread and unknown to those of us who, I guess, just.
Yeah. Did you pick this story or did someone send it to you? I'm just curious.
Someone sent it to me to say, hey, you guys talked about this before. Here's your update. And yeah, okay. So that's it. I don't know how you and I talked about this before. I don't know how you police something like this. You're in the middle of an intimate activity with someone, could be your spouse, could be a boyfriend or girlfriend, a partner. And then suddenly they slip off the prophylactic. How do you police that? Like that seems like the most difficult, unless you've got video, I guess. I don't know. It raises a whole bunch of, no pun intended, hairy questions.
See, I think that when you don't know how something can be policed, it's because you lack the imagination. I'll tell you right now, you police it.
Tell me.
You have got to make sexual encounters illegal without a witness.
I like that. No more. And yeah, because I was going to say that for a while there were these people who were joking that you just had to have a consent form and a signature line on your tattooed on your body.
Well, yeah, but see, someone can sign a consent form, but then the stealthing thing is like a whole nother deal.
Yes.
And I think, and by the way, when I say eyewitness, I'm not sure that you can monitor stealthing from 4, 5, 6 feet away.
You really can't.
You might need to be
intimately involved.
Not involved in the intimate act. I don't want to be creepy here, but I'm saying they need to like sit on the bed. Listen, if you're going to bring this nonsense up, like some reader, like, is there anything a reader can send you that you wouldn't bring up on air?
Yeah, we got a few things.
And then, by the way, I want to make clear, they're not saying then one does stealthing and then someone ends up getting pregnant or ends up getting venereal disease or HIV. They're saying just the act of the stealth thing. You know what I think could eliminate the risk of some of this? And I want you, and by the way, who's stealthing? Would this just be the men or the women?
Well, the article points to facts from, this is how far these people have to go to prove this is a thing. They cite a study in Australia that showed that some 38% or 32% of women and
any stealthing there? They've shut down the whole entire island. You can't even meet anybody.
Well, I think the very fact that it's called Down Under suggests something stealthy about Australians.
Well, let me tell you something. This is very important. I appreciate you bringing this up. Here's my suggestion. Ann Coulter, who I'm not a fan of, but every now and then can be capable of saying something very clever, very witty. After that Duke lacrosse rape trial in which these men were falsely accused of raping a stripper who they hired to come to their party. And there's a whole best-selling book written on it. And it was really an incredible case, but ahead of its time of injustice against unlikable, wealthy, white, privileged people in what was, and the district attorney lost his job over it, I think went to prison. I mean, it was a big mess. But Ann Coulter said, this whole story goes to tell you that you have much less chance of getting raped if you don't go take your clothes off for money at a frat party. And you have much less chance of getting falsely accused of rape if you don't hire someone to come take their clothes off for you at a drunken frat party. And here's what I would suggest for the women who are afraid of stealthing. Know your partner, be in love before you have them in your bed. How'd I do, Lil? What do you think?
You're crazy.
I'm just throwing it out there, man. I'm just throwing it out there. Stealthing.
Oh my,
I swear. We've talked more about sex on this episode than I've talked about it in 25 years. Wait, how long have I been married? 30 years.
And I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Okay, I got to go, Will.
Can I ask you one last question?
Yes.
Okay. Last one.
Not about stealthing.
Is this about stealthing? No, this is stealth banking. This is California could soon have its own public banking service under new law. We talked about this, right? That California is going to get into the banking business. No irony here. They just lost up to $31 billion in unemployment fraud that they still can't figure out. But they're going to run a bank, or at least they're going to study whether
they
should.
I told you my idea on this. I used to be against it, and I told you I've changed.
Because? Proceed.
I think they can run branches right out of the DMV. And you don't have to hire any new people.
Okay, but to be
they're already trained. You got the A-team, you got the A-team locked and loaded.
to be fair, this is actually just to study this, David. So I want to ask you, Rich Lowry, the editor's podcast style exit question. Chances that you think this study will lead to a California state public bank? 0, no chance. 10, we're absolutely gonna get a state bank at the end of this study.
Okay, so 0 to 10. I would say a 100% chance that it will reveal a very, very, very bad idea of, and that it's a 30% chance it will still happen.
I disagree. I think we're going to have a study that shows it's great, it's necessary, and it will cover up all the failures.
You got to remember, well, there are politicians out there that are afraid of being embarrassed. They're wrong a lot of things, but one of the things they do, like, this is something that a lot of really big statists could look at and go, dude, what are we kidding? I mean, are you kidding? We don't know what we're doing here. I don't think they want that egg on their face. I don't see this thing. I'm not saying zero, but it's not, I'm not sure. But that's, you're asking me to predict what will happen, not what should happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. All right. Well, I know it's getting late out there for you. That's all we have time for today. My friends, you can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and far better for us if you just subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. You can email us. You'll find our email addresses, Twitter handles, and other fun details in the show notes. On behalf of my friend and co-host, David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our recording engineers, Brian Tong and Glenn Hall. Hey, guys, and to all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that CLA-based mariachi and metal band, for our intro music and our outro music. You're going to hear it here in one moment. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.